This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Peace Works, presenting the second annual Gala Mardi Gras benefit, Saturday, February 25th, 6 p.m. at the Grand Ballroom in downtown Salem, featuring music by Kate Sullivan and Company, Voodoo Mountain Zydeco, and Zydeco Dance Lesson by Deborah Seek, plus the political satire of Dr. Atomic's Medicine Show, with New Orleans-style food included, auction with unusual items, and no-host bar. Tickets at 503-585-2767 or OregonPeaceWorks.org. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, introducing Pete's E-Cups, letting you send a friend a cup. On the web at Pete's.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
To be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Fiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Pacific Corps is trying to raise Oregon's electrical rates again.
Investigators can find no definitive cause of fires at weapons depots in Oregon and around the nation.
And on Free Speech Radio News at 525, the debate continues over Dubai-owned security at major U.S. ports.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,287 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded.
IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,119 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 23, 2006. I'm Eduardo Delanderos Tierra.
And I'm SW Conser.
Pacific Corps filed with the Oregon Public Utility Commission today, seeking an overall increase in rates. The corporation seeks an increase of 13.2%, effective in December. The Scotland-based utility serves 535,000 electricity customers in Oregon. The company has requested 5 general rate increases in the last 10 years. As proposed, the rate increase request includes a 10.8% hike in rates for residential customers and a 19.8% increase for large industrial customers. An average Pacific Power residential customer using 1,000 kilowatt hours of electricity a month would see their bill for electricity service go from $67 a month to $74.24 a month. The big drivers of the increase, according to the company, are increased operating costs. It's also known that last year, utility speculator Warren Buffett's holding company agreed to buy Pacific Corps from British Scottish Power, PLC, for $5.1 billion in cash, plus debt assumption of $4.3 billion. So far, the deal is a no-go because of federal antitrust laws governing utility mergers.
Dramatic changes in Oregon's HIV reporting system are on the agenda in a series of meetings to be held throughout the state in March. The current system, which uses codes to protect the identities of those who test positive for HIV, is being discarded to comply with federal requirements. Oregon stands to lose 30 to 40% of the $10 million it receives in federal AIDS treatment annually if it does not comply with the new regulations. This money is used in part for expensive antiviral drug cocktails, which can cost between $15,000 and $20,000 a year. Current state regulations require the reporting of names of those who have progressed to AIDS, but not in the case of HIV. Hearings will be held throughout the state, and the public is encouraged to attend and participate. In Bend, at Monday, March 20th, from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Deschutes County Health Department. In Eugene, Wednesday, March 22nd, from 9 to 11 a.m. at Lane County Mental Health. In Portland, Friday, March 24th, from 9 a.m. to noon at the Portland State Office Building.
The Portland City Council has taken some first steps against payday loan companies that have sprung up throughout the area. KBOO's Spencer Raymond reports on the new rights borrowers have.
The Portland City Council has taken the first step in the fight to crack down on Oregon's fast-growing payday loan industry. It unanimously passed a law last night that gives borrowers more rights, including payoff options and the ability to cancel a loan within 24 hours. However, the city doesn't have the power to put limits on the interest charged, which can exceed an annual rate of 500%. Angela Martin with Oregon Food Bank says when loans continue to compound at an exponential rate, it forces families to turn to places like the food bank for help.
Everyone deserves access to affordable credit. The staggering costs of these loans are a burden for families and for communities. The debt burden this is creating is just creating problems both at a personal level and at a community level.
The industry opposed the regulations, saying they limit consumers' choices. City leaders in Gresham and Troutdale are considering similar laws, and a ballot measure is circulating that would limit interest rates on payday loans. Oregon is one of seven states without a cap on interest rates. Rick Bennett with AARP Oregon testified before the vote that short-term loans tend to hurt older and low-income Oregonians the most. And he says it's time to level the playing field.
It's clearly predatory lending. Individuals who have to go out and buy some prescription drugs or something, they're in a situation where they've got to do something immediately. So they're at a disadvantage.
Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Spencer Raymond, KBOO News.
Now callers in many parts of Washington can dial a simple three-digit number, 211, to get information about services ranging from volunteer opportunities to domestic violence shelters. Launched by the United Way, the Social Service Hotline has four calling centers that serve about 60% of the state's population. A center in Yakima serves Kittitas, Yakima, Franklin, Benton, and Walla Walla counties. The other centers are Clark County in southwest Washington, King County, which serves the Seattle area, and the North Sound Center, which serves Island, San Juan, Skagit, Snohomish, and Whatcom counties. By dialing 911 on a landline telephone, callers will be connected to an operator who can search a database of thousands of social service agencies and help them find what they need. The Washington Information Network 211 hopes to have the service available to all Washington residents by next year, but it will take time for the service to be available to cell phone users.
An educational nonprofit group called the Chalkboard Project recently joined with the Oregon Department of Education to bridge the communication gap between public schools and 70,000 hard-to-reach families around the state. So here in Studio 2 is Shirley Skidmore of the Chalkboard Project to talk about the program. Thanks for being here, Shirley.
You're very welcome.
Well, let's first start out with asking you, what is the Chalkboard Project?
The Chalkboard Project is a nonprofit organization that was created by five of Oregon's more prominent foundations a couple of years ago. They all have an interest in Oregon's K-12 education system, have given a lot of money to education issues and projects, and they felt that they could combine their forces to do more good for K-12 schools and try to address many of the challenges we have out there.
And how long has the project been around?
It's been about 2 years, and the founding partners were the Oregon Community Foundation, the Collins Foundation, the Ford Family Foundation, the Geldwin Foundation, and the Meyer Memorial Trust.
Great. So first tell us about the hard-to-reach families. We know part of this issue has to do with so-called minority and low-income families. Is this an achievement gap or a communications gap?
It's really both. Both of those gaps are really real. Low-income and ethnic minority students perform disproportionately lower on standardized tests. They have higher dropout rates, that kind of thing. But also, you would also discover that there's a communications gap, especially with ethnic minority families, for which language is a barrier. If they're new to this country, they don't understand how to navigate our education system. Our research clearly shows that the more parents are involved in their children's learning, the higher their achievement. And that's a real struggle for many families who are are just struggling to put food on the table or learn a new culture.
Surely, we see and read and hear so many conflicting stories in the media about educational test scores and educational failures, so-called failures. Just this month, we heard that Oregon students are doing better on standardized tests, and we've also read that they are doing worse at the same time. How can we really judge progress and on this achievement, so-called achievement gap?
Well, first of all, you have to look below those headlines because both of those statements you made are true. Achievement is going up in this state among all groups. The problem is we have a real gap between the haves and have-nots, if you will. And is that gap closing? You have to look more deeply at the demographic data on test scores. You have to look at some national comparisons, too. Oregon students take some national tests. And by some indications, our performance is going down overall in comparison to students in other parts of the country. So there's a gap there as well. So both of those statistics are real, and you have to look a little more closely at the data to discover especially the why behind that.
On this project, you're working with a State Department of Education. What's their role here?
Well, basically, we have two projects. The one we're doing with the Department of Education is designed to create a template, if you will, on how to reach out to parents throughout the state, not just the hard-to-reach families, but all parents. And we are offering, Chalkboard is offering $1,000 stipends to 10 schools in the state who are willing to try some innovative things to reach out to parents. The Oregon Department of Energy's, the Department of Education's role is to help make this a statewide program and hopefully to create a template that they will share with all the districts in the state and hopefully begin measuring at some point parent involvement in schools. We have another project we're doing alone as Chalkboard that's aimed just at hard-to-reach families. It's called Running Start, and it's a toolkit that we're going to have online by the end of April that will provide staff members at schools much more information about the barriers that many of these parents are facing and how to work with families to get them more engaged in their children's education.
Thanks, Shirley. That was Shirley Skidmore of the Chalkboard Project. Find out more about their work at www.chalkboardproject.org, or you can call 503-542-4325.
A months-long investigation into 21 fires at chemical weapons incinerators in Oregon and around the nation found no definite cause. The U.S. Army Chemical Materials Agency says beads of nitroglycerin condensation sweating from rocket propellant are the most likely cause for a series of fires at the Umatilla Chemical Depot's incinerator. The Army started investigating after fires hit the incinerator near Hermiston last year as rockets were dismantled for incineration. No one was hurt, but incineration work at the plant was stopped for weeks. Scientists tested 9 rockets from Umatilla and found nitroglycerin-rich liquid beads on the surface of each rocket's propellant cylinder. Similar liquid was found on 6 of 9 rockets tested from a depot in Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
A federal judge has dismissed a legal challenge to logging trees in roadless areas killed by the 2002 Biscuit Fire in southern Oregon. A U.S. District Judge Michael Hogan in Eugene dismissed consolidated lawsuits that challenge logging in old-growth forest reserves and roadless areas of the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forests. Another judge in Medford had recommended dismissal last July after rejecting all claims by environmental groups that the Forest Service failed to adequately protect old-growth forest reserves, roadless areas, and fish habitat from intensive logging. Sparked by lightning, the Biscuit Fire burned 500,000 acres in the summer of 2002, making it the largest fire in the country that year.
Oregon's low-wage workers are already struggling to make ends meet. But a new report shows Oregon has some of the highest income taxes in the nation for low-income working families.
As Oregonians start preparing their taxes, low-income families are getting hit hard. A new report shows Oregon has among the highest income taxes in the nation on poor and low-income working families. Oregon is one of a minority of states with income taxes that tax families living below the poverty line. Michael Leachman with the Oregon Center for Public Policy, which co-released the report, says Oregon's poor pay a larger share of their income in taxes than other taxpayers.
Oregon should not be making it harder for low-wage working families to put food on the table and keep a roof over their heads.
Leachman says the easiest way to help lower taxes for low-income working families is to expand the state earned income tax credit. He says the legislature did enact a slight increase last session, but it was only a small improvement. Leachman also says that voters approved cost of living increases in the minimum wage to help low-income families.
Oregon voters have made it clear that they want families working in minimum wage jobs to be able to meet their basic needs. The income taxes that Oregon requires these families to pay undermines the voters' will.
Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Jessica Perry, KBOO News.
The current time is just a little after 5:15. And now, of course, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
I hope you haven't just eaten, because we need to talk about horse meat. It's not widely known, but there are 3 horse slaughter factories in the U.S., 2 in Texas, 1 in Illinois. Each year, some 90,000 horses are trucked to these facilities, where they are killed, some die an agonizing death, chopped and ground into meat, then shipped off to be someone's dinner. Americans, however, don't eat horse meat. It's no longer even used for pet food here. This meat goes to Europe. 2 of the slaughterhouses in our country are owned by Belgians, the other by French investors. Okay, they fancy horse meat, but we don't have to provide it. In China, people eat cats. Shall we let Chinese investors build a kitty cat slaughterhouse here? The good news is that an overwhelming bipartisan majority in Congress passed an amendment in December to put a temporary halt to the slaughter of horses for human consumption. The bad news is that Bush is in office. Astonishingly, the Bushites are siding with the 3 foreign horse meat corporations, defying the direct order of Congress to stop the killing. What Congress did was to amend the Ag Department's appropriations bill to say that none of its money could be spent to inspect horse meat plants in the next year. No inspection, no meat. No meat, no slaughterhouse. But that underestimates the corporate servility and autocratic arrogance of the Bushites. Bush ag officials have ruled that while the amendment prevents spending the department's money for horse meat inspection, the 3 companies can pay the inspectors themselves under a special fee-for-service arrangement, thus continuing the slaughter and the shipping. This is Jim Hightower saying, our ag officials also are trying to let the foreign firms do this without even allowing we the people to comment. If you do want to speak your mind, however, here's Bush's Secretary of Agriculture's phone number, 202-720-3631. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Proverbial Perspectives. Host Wiley G. Barnett speaks with political candidates Xander Patterson and Bruce Broussard on barriers to full participation in the electoral system. At 7, it's Good Times with Reggae Bob. Tonight's weather, rainy in Portland and Salem, lows just above freezing. In Hood River, rain's decreasing tonight, snow level down to 1,000 feet. Tomorrow, partly sunny in Portland, colder in Salem. In Hood River, morning clouds, then partly sunny. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The last unit assigned to support B-52 bombers at Fairchild Air Force Base has been shut down. For 12 years, the 2nd Support Squadron has stored and maintained cruise missiles at the base for use by B-52 bombers in action, including the ongoing war in Iraq. The squadron finished yesterday with the usual patriotic ceremony. The base now goes to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. It's home to the 2nd Bomb Wing. The Fairchild's main mission now will be flying air refueling tankers.
MoveOn.org organized small vigils across the country yesterday to protest illegal wiretapping. About 40 people gathered in southeast Portland to hold signs and candles, hoping to raise awareness about the issue. KBOO's Julie Sabatier was there and collected this audio collage.
Well, I signed up with MoveOn.org. I realized that at the time there were none scheduled for Portland, so I signed up as a host. The reason we selected this intersection is because it's high visibility.
We're standing on the corner, the four corners of 39th and Division, and we're getting really good response from the passersby and the cars that are returning home from a day of work. And we're here to focus on the illegal wiretapping that the administration is doing.
Well, I think it's a matter of kind of people raising people's awareness of what's going on. It's hard for me to understand why people haven't stood up more against it, but I guess this is just a little thing that I can do.
As you can tell by the horns honking, a lot of people agree with us.
And we, the people, are going to have to get involved if we're going to change anything.
But what if everybody stayed home? They would think, hey, it's okay what they're doing.
I'm no Clinton fan, but, you know, if they impeach Clinton for, you know, lying about sex in the Oval Office, they should, you know, hold Bush accountable for the lies that got us into Iraq and for the lies about the wiretapping that's going on.
So I'm just on my way home, but it's interesting.
I'm totally for it. I hate Bush. I hate him.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like standing with a sign on the side of the road.
Why not?
I don't think it's really accomplishing anything, I guess.
I come to protest. That's my thing. I come to several of these.
And do you feel like it's helping?
Helps me.
I feel that every time people see resistance to this madness, that their fear is overcome a little bit. And these guys are the masters of the politics of fear.
It has a corrosive effect on society. When people can't trust their phone lines, when they can't trust their privacy, it corrodes the bonds of civilization and of democracy, and it leads us down toward a police state.
I think it's cool to see so many different people. Like, there's older people and people in business suits and hippies and all kinds of stuff. So I think it's awesome.
I'm so frustrated. I'm so angry at this, the populace of this country, that they're not getting out there and up in arms. You know, the world is looking at us. And what's going to happen? Are we going to be like the Germans?
To all my congressmen, I write letters. There's this rally. It's just that there are fires everywhere, and we can't. I just feel helpless. So I got to do something.
I think it's a way of people being able to see how many people really feel the same way. That it's not just a few people. That it gives safety in numbers. Although I don't know what kind of safety there is anymore.
Taping conversations of activists like me is not going to stop international terrorism.
Wherever you are in America, you have to stand up and say, if somebody's breaking the law, they need to stop, and it doesn't matter who they are.
I'm just coming out here to see what's going on, see, join all these good folks in protesting. With all the people that are honking their horns, we hope that these people will call their congressional leaders and senators.
That was an audio collage compiled by Julie Sabatier. That's the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 23rd, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Our assistant producers are Jessica and Kurt Perry. Tonight's audio editors are Rabia Yeaman and Michael Duo. Special thanks to reporters Spencer Raymond, Julie Sabatier, and Jessica Perry. Our engineer is Brian Averill. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm S.W. Conser.
And I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., here are the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, hear Our Strategies, Our Needs. It's the first in a series of dialogues on the relationships between people of color and our communities. I, Eduardo, will be hosting that dialogue. At 10, it's the KBOO Report with Robinette Jones. At 10:30, Pat McGuire hosts the KBOO report. And then at 11, it's Democracy Now! And that's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and of course, listener-sponsored community radio station. Mil gracias, amor y poesía. Ciao.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, February 23, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. The European Parliament Committee begins hearings today into the practice of so-called extraordinary rendition, and a group of lawyers goes after FEMA. We'll hear the latest from New Orleans.
I was approved for a trailer. Do you have somewhere to put the trailer? No. Would you like a commercial site? Yes. That was in November. It's February. I ain't hear nothing else about a trailer.
We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Voters in Uganda went to the polls today in the country's first multi-party elections in 25 years. The 20-year-long rule of President Yoweri Museveni is being challenged by his former doctor, Kizza Besigye. Dr. Besigye returned from exile after announcing his presidential aspirations, but was later arrested and made to stand trial for what he says are politically motivated charges. If neither of the top contenders wins an absolute majority in the first round, a runoff vote will be scheduled for next month. Some opposition supporters have already made allegations of voting irregularities. In other election news, Oscar Arias has unofficially been declared the president-elect of Costa Rica. The announcement comes after more than 2 weeks of ballot counting in a very close race. Arias reportedly won by a razor-thin margin of 0.2 percentage point, which translates to just over 18,000 votes. Costa Rica's electoral tribunal has yet to certify the results. Sectarian violence between Christians and Muslims that started over the weekend continues in Nigeria. Samuel Lakoya reports from Lagos.
The southern city of Onitsha has witnessed the worst of the sectarian violence. Residents of the city speak of angry youths with clubs and knives roaming the streets in search of Muslims from northern Nigeria. More than 100 people, mainly Muslims, have been killed in the city, while several mosques have been burnt down. Similar attacks were carried out against the Muslim populace in a few other Christian-dominated cities in southern and central Nigeria. Southern Christians took up arms against northern Muslims following earlier killings of Christians in northern Nigeria over the weekend. In the northern city of Maiduguri, Muslim youths protesting the publication of cartoons of Prophet Muhammad in a Danish newspaper killed 51 Christians and burnt 30 churches. In another northern city, 15 Christians were killed by Muslims who claimed a Christian woman desecrated the Holy Quran. With the violence threatening to spread to other parts of Nigeria, both Christian and Muslim religious leaders have appealed for calm. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
The Israeli army has moved back into the West Bank city of Nablus and its nearby refugee camp after a temporary withdrawal on Wednesday. Manar Jibrin reports.
On Thursday, Israeli forces killed 5 people in the 5th straight day of invasions of the Balata refugee camp located in Nablus in the northern part of the West Bank. 3 resistance fighters were killed after Israeli Apache gunship fired its heavy machine guns at them in the evening. The other 2 casualties were civilians who were shot dead this morning. Israeli forces backed by bulldozers, military jeeps and armored personnel carriers invaded the city of Nablus and Balata refugee camp in the early morning hours, while Apache helicopters continued to circle overhead. After a 4-day invasion which killed 5 Palestinians and injured dozens, Israeli forces withdrew for part of Wednesday. At least 50 Israeli military vehicles backed by bulldozers reinvaded Nablus just after midnight and closed the main streets of the city with roadblocks. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
Just days before President George W. Bush's visit to India, U.S. Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns met with India's Foreign Secretary today to fine-tune the implementation of the civilian nuclear agreement. From New Delhi, our correspondent Vinod Kejoz reports.
There's no question that both of us want to complete these negotiations, but there are still some remaining differences between us, and those differences need to be worked out, as President Bush said, in his speech yesterday, the plan must be credible, transparent. And
the separation of civil nuclear programs from its military reactors seems to be a tough job for India. Indian nuclear scientists think this would mean exposing Indian nuclear technology to the US officials. And some of them have openly stated that it is against India's national interest. But the Indian administration in Delhi wants to push the civilian nuclear agreement signed between both the countries to its next stage. US administration is apparently very keen on the business of selling nuclear energy technology to India. US Undersecretary of State Nicholas Burns has visited India 3 times in this regard to resolve what he calls the differences. It is uncertain as of now if a nuclear deal can be reached before President Bush visits Delhi next week. From New Delhi in India, this is Vinod K. Chose for FSR.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice traveled to the United Arab Emirates, a country she calls a strong ally of the United States. On Capitol Hill, meanwhile, senators question administration officials over the management of port terminals by a Dubai-owned firm. Senators expressed concerns about national security, while administration officials defended the UAE as a reliable partner in the war on terror. Leanne Caldwell has more on this story from Capitol Hill.
Before some members of the Senate Armed Services Committee, administration officials from the Departments of Homeland Security, Treasury, Defense, and State defended the United Arab Emirates as a key ally to the war on terror. Gordon England is Deputy Secretary at the Department of Defense.
We rely on them for our security in their country, and I appreciate and thank them for that.
But in his line of questioning, Ranking Democrat Carl Levin from Michigan disputed those claims.
The United Arab Emirates was becoming both a valued counterterrorism ally of the United States and a persistent counterterrorism problem. It's a mixed bag, according to the 9/11 Commission. Did any of you talk to the 9/11 commissioners about that representation finding of theirs? Just raise your hand if anybody talked to the 9/11 commissioners. Anybody talked to them? No. Okay.
The briefing is over Dubai World Ports, a company owned and operated by the United Arab Emirates. They recently bought a port terminal company based in Great Britain. The company will now have managerial duties on 24 port terminals at 6 ports in the United States. The Senate Armed Services Committee held a briefing to better understand the agreement. All 9 administration officials present said that the agreement underwent a thorough security investigation. That investigation was done by the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS. Committee Chair Mark Warner from Virginia asked the panel about a law, which was passed in 1992, that would send a controversial deal such as this to Congress and allow for a 45-day review.
As I read the statute, it's more or less discretionary. But that discretion is exercised, Secretary Kimmett, if any of the CFIUS members decide that it should be done. Your judgment.
Robert Kimmett, the Deputy Secretary for the Department of Treasury, which is the lead agency in CFIUS, responds to Senator Warner's question.
Senator, we have a difference of opinion on the interpretation of your amendment. It is now a 14-year difference of opinion because this amendment has been interpreted by successive administrations since 1992 as being discretionary, as the chairman described, and that is that it would require a member of CFIUS raising a potential concern.
Kimmett says that not one of the 12 government agencies under CFIUS raised national security concerns. But senators said they see a need for congressional review and charge that the administration chose to skip that step. Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton from New York maintains that a foreign company owned by a foreign government, such as Dubai World Ports, should receive the strictest scrutiny for controlling an aspect of U.S. ports. Although foreign authority of U.S. ports does occur, no agency present at the hearing today was able to confirm that specific number or from what countries. Free Speech Radio News asked the senators if their concerns were justified. To the senators, do you think it's a double standard?
that this is an Arab-based company.
Senator Clinton responded.
May I respond to that for a minute, Mr. Chairman? You know, we hear on a fairly regular basis that we live in a post-9/11 world, and sometimes that's used as a declarative statement, and sometimes it's used as a political attack. But the fact is we do live in a post-9/11 world, and I think it's important that whatever the interpretations of the statute was in the past, that there is now a necessity for a heightened scrutiny.
Senator Clinton will introduce legislation that bans the sale of any aspects of U.S. ports to an outside company whose government has financial control. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
Some news agencies are reporting that Shiites have killed more than 100 Sunni Arabs in Iraq following the destruction on Wednesday of the venerated Askariya Mosque in Samarra, north of Baghdad. More than 100 Sunni mosques around the country were attacked and some destroyed. In this report produced and narrated by David Enders, Salam Talib speaks with Abbas al-Rubai, the editor of Al-Hawza newspaper in Baghdad.
Al-Hawza, named for Iraq's Shiite seminary, often takes an editorial line similar to that of cleric Muqtada Sadr, who found himself appealing for calm following the bombings, while Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who in the past has urged Sadr's militia to show more restraint during clashes with U.S. and Iraqi government forces, encouraged demonstrations and suggested Shiite militias play a larger role in providing security in the country. The mostly Sunni city of Samarra has been the scene of frequent fighting between the U.S. military and guerrillas, with the U.S. claiming the city had been taken or pacified repeatedly, only to see the rebels assert themselves again. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the blast. Many Iraqis blamed the U.S., at least in part, and also cast suspicion upon secularists in the country, including the U.S.-backed Iyad Alawi. Rather than blame extremist Sunnis who consider Shia heretics, Rubai suggested that a party like Alawi's, that did not fare well in January's elections, might be to blame. For many Shiites, the most potent symbols of Shiite repression are those of secular governments like Saddam Hussein's, during which time religious processions were banned and pilgrimages to shrines like the one in Samarra were curtailed.
The people that think the attacks came from the Sunnis are not right, because Iyad Alawi and Salah al-Mutlaq are both secular. They subscribe to the so-called New Ba'ath nationalism. The reaction from people to attack the Sunni mosque is not the right reaction. We don't think that the majority of Sunnis in Samarra attacked the shrine because they depended economically on the tourism and visiting to the shrine every day. It has been a source of income for them.
Despite such rhetoric, many Sunni leaders blamed Sadr's followers for the attacks on their mosques. Whether destruction of the shrine will be the prelude to open civil war remains to be seen. Low-level sectarian hostilities, especially clandestine extrajudicial killings, have been taking place for months, but Rubai pointed out that Shiites have endured attacks against holy sites and religious processions, some causing hundreds of casualties, frequently during the last 2 years.
We do not think it will be civil war in Iraq, because the reaction of Iraqis through all their experience in the bombing of their holy shrines were not so violent.
But with elections over and negotiations to form a government on hold because of the violence, reports of bodies being found on Thursday continue to come in. The Iraqi government has extended a pre-existing curfew in Baghdad and Salah ad-Din province, where Samarra is located. Curfew is now at 8 in the evening. Also on Thursday, three Iraqi journalists apparently trying to cover the breaking events were found dead near Samarra. Al-Arabiya's Atwar Badshat, one of the few women covering the war, and two colleagues were found shot to death near their satellite van. I'm David Enders with Salam Talib for FSRN.
A European Parliamentary Committee began its first hearings today as it investigates the use of European territory by the CIA for the transport and illegal detention of terrorism suspects, as investigations continue throughout the world looking into the practice of so-called extraordinary rendition, the transport of people by the United States from jurisdictions where torture is illegal to jurisdictions where torture is permissible in order to carry out interrogation. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
So far, investigations into the allegations about the practice of so-called extraordinary rendition have concluded that there was at the very least cooperation with the US by European countries. The hearings starting today are trying to establish the level of this cooperation. EU Justice Minister Franco Frattini has threatened to take away EU voting rights from any country found to be involved.
If there would be evidence of a state having allowed on its territory camps or prisons or something like that, not in compliance with European and international standards on the treatment of prisoners, we would have the duty to declare a serious violation of the treaty.
To be found violating international and European law is the last thing any European government wants. There's mounting political pressure on them to come clean. Liberal Democrat Member of Parliament Mingus Campbell.
We know that extraordinary rendition is being practiced. We know that a large number of CIA flights go through United Kingdom airports. We need full disclosure by the government. The Foreign Affairs Select Committee in the last Parliament described their responses to questions as being a policy of obfuscation and not answering questions sufficiently frankly.
Member of the European Parliament Sarah Ludford is Vice Chair of the Special European Parliamentary Investigating Committee.
We only have the power of political persuasion to persuade governments and any other governmental agencies to cooperate with us. Our committee has no powers of summoning of witnesses. We can't order the production of documents. If it was a trade or industrial matter, then we would have stronger powers. But as we're inquiring into human rights aspects, strangely enough, even though they're incredibly important, if you like, to the whole values of the EU, we don't have such powers.
That's a hangover, she says, from when the European Community was first set up 50 years ago, primarily as a trading project. But investigations such as these are charting new territory for an EU that's putting human rights as one of its core objectives, along with trade. Sharmi Chakrabarti of civil rights group Liberty.
The allegations, the suspicions, the circumstantial evidence gives serious enough concern that we should ask chief constables to do their duty. They have positive obligations under international law and under our Human Rights Act to investigate.
And that's just what British police are currently doing. Member of the European Parliament Sarah Ludford believes this European process will eventually bring about prosecutions, and not only in Britain.
Certainly, if there has been breaches of international law, then we would expect the police and the judicial authorities of the member states to take an interest, as is already, of course, happening in Italy. The Italian judicial authorities have issued arrest warrants for 22 alleged CIA personnel allegedly involved in the abduction of Abu Omar from Milan to Egypt, where he was tortured. So there you do have the criminal justice authorities involved. It's an opportunity for parliamentary and human rights Europe, civil society Europe, to pull together and to call on our governments to account for anything that they might have done.
Many hope this inquiry will help establish new European Union functions and institutions designed to better enforce international law and protect human rights, as well as stopping possible collaboration by governments in such illegal activity in the future. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Angry protests took place in the town of Hundwada in Indian-administered Kashmir, where four youth were allegedly killed in cold blood on Wednesday by the Indian Army. Demonstrators took to the streets for a second day, refusing to bury the dead unless the culprits were arrested. Kashmir also witnessed protests in Shia-dominated areas against the bombing of the Shia shrine in Samarra, Iraq. FSRN's Shahnawaz Khan has more.
Angry slogans against the Indian Army in the Hundwada town of Indian-administered Kashmir. A local cricket ground ran red on Wednesday in Dodipura village when four youth were killed, allegedly in an unprovoked shooting by the Indian Army. Two of the youths killed were minors. Local witnesses say the Indian Army laid siege to the area and opened fire on young people who were playing cricket. Bashir Ahmed Bhatt is a local resident.
The children were playing in the cricket ground. The army captain Ramu came along with his soldiers. The children had to cross the nearby stream. The soldiers opened fire on the children.
The Indian Army denied the allegations, saying the four were killed in crossfire between the army and militants hiding in the area. An army spokesman said the army had information about militants hiding in the area and laid a siege to nab them. The spokesman added that militants opened fire on the army, killing the four young people. But there are no takers for this version. According to local witnesses in town, like Nisa Ahmed, the army version is a total lie.
The army version is a total lie. There were neither any militants, nor were there any firing by militants. There were only these four children. They were playing and had to cross the river. They were ordered hands up, and they obliged. Still, they were fired upon and killed.
The separatist groups in Indian-administered Kashmir condemned and protested the incident. Hardline separatist leader Syed Ali Shah Gilani had been kept under house arrest to prevent him from visiting Handwara. Gilani has called for a two-day shutdown strike against the incident. Meanwhile, the government of Jammu and Kashmir has ordered a magisterial inquiry into the incident. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
A group of lawyers in New Orleans is suing the Federal Emergency Management Agency today, alleging that the agency has not provided adequate assistance to Hurricane Katrina evacuees. Attorneys say that FEMA has taken too long to process aid applications and is inadequate in calculating factors such as the actual cost of living and family size when granting assistance. FSRN's Mabe Liebenthal has more.
Though the revelry of Carnival is in the air, thousands are scrambling for housing as the March 1st deadline for hotel residents approaches. Displaced resident Brittany Brown is staying at the Astor Crown Plaza Hotel on the FEMA voucher program.
Come back home. Come back home to where? To what? Jefferson Parish don't want us. And when you do go over there, the housing is ridiculously high. You can't go uptown because that one bedroom starting at $1,000+.
Today, lawyers from the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights are continuing their lawsuit against FEMA to ensure that people are properly assisted by the federal agency. According to the committee, FEMA is in violation of the Stafford Act, which is the statute that says how assistance is to be distributed in a disaster situation. They are trying to prove that FEMA has not provided the assistance required by law to those displaced. The requirements include the necessity for a fair and consistent administrative procedure and adequate rental assistance. The initial $2,358 rental assistance granted to some households may not be considered sufficient to some. John K. Pierre of the Southern University Law Center explains.
They haven't done what they were mandated to do under the Stafford Act. For example, they are mandated to provide either financial assistance in terms of rental assistance or actually temporary housing. For example, they are mandated, in our view, to provide continuing housing assistance up to the statutory period of 18 months. We're arguing also that the 2358 is insufficient because they are supposed to provide housing assistance which meets the fair market rental guidelines established by HUD, Housing and Urban Development, plus assistance for utilities and transportation.
However, FEMA moved to dismiss the case, citing sovereign immunity. This means that FEMA asserts that the assistance it provides is meant to be temporary and people are not entitled to it like other federal assistance programs such as Social Security. Federal Judge Duval rejected the dismissal and continued with the trial. With the proceedings set to end this afternoon, hurricane survivors are hoping that they will be able to remain in hotels until adequate alternatives for housing will be provided. Up to 50,000 evacuees nationwide are still in hotels waiting for assistance. Several thousand were already driven out of hotels last week when the second wave of hotel evictions occurred. Lawyers sought to prevent this by filing a temporary restraining order, which was denied in federal court. Brittany Brown, who has been offered a trailer but has nowhere to put it, shares her concern.
I got called 2 weeks or the week before Thanksgiving asking if I wanted a trailer. I said, yeah, I was approved for a trailer. Do you have somewhere to put the trailer? No. Would you like a commercial site? Yes. That was in November. It's February. I ain't hear nothing else about a trailer. My aunt been waiting on the trailer. Been. Since October. She calls me every day. the trailers that they have set up, why nobody not sending those? But you want everybody to come back. Where are we going?
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Maya Beliebenthal.
Chile's environmental agency gave approval last week to a controversial gold mining project. The gold mine is nestled at the top of the fertile Huasco Valley in the high Andes, just at the south edge of the Atacama Desert, known to be one of the driest places in the world. The gold mine project, known as Pascua-Lama, is being developed by the Canadian mining giant Barrick Gold. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has more.
The Huasco Valley is a near pristine, unique ecosystem that runs from the Andes Mountains to the Pacific Ocean at the southern edge of the Atacama Desert. After 4 years, Canadian mining giant Barrick Gold was approved to operate an open-pit gold mine known as Pascua-Lama high up in the Andes. The controversy began with Barrick Gold's announcement that it would relocate three glaciers that feed into the rivers that irrigate the fertile Huasco Valley. But Barrick Gold was told it can develop the mine but not touch the glaciers. Environmental groups and local residents have organized to stop the Pascua-Lama mine, fearing an end to their valley and their ability to maintain a sustainable economy based on agriculture and rural tourism. Mirna Inostroza with Defend the Huasco Valley Council says the gold mine was approved despite the opposition of residents, farmers, and environmental groups.
One can see this was a political decision from high up because it was quickly approved, despite all the scientific, community testimony, and expert evidence. Mining is not environmentally friendly. That is a concept miners invented. But mining is not sustainable or compatible with agriculture and tourism.
But not all valley residents agree with those opposed to the gold mine. Farmers who depend on the proper management of irrigation and their water rights had to protect their interest by siding with Barrick Gold. Fernando Gonzalez, the president of the Association of the Huasco Valley Farmers, says the only way to ensure a clean, sustainable watershed it was to become a partner of Barrick Gold.
For them to enter our valley, they needed our support so we could guarantee the quantity and quality of our waters. That is the reason we reached an agreement with the company. The environmental risks have diminished because the measures taken to protect our water resources.
The gold mine will operate for 20 years. Barrick Gold is investing $1.6 billion and will create some 4,500 jobs during the construction phase of the mine and will have 1,500 miners for mining operations. The mine will have 70% of its operation in Chile and 30% in the Argentine side of the Andes Mountains. Environmentalists fear the 2,200-foot mountain Barrick Gold will build from waste rock will leach into the watershed and underground waters. Antonio Fort, an environmental engineer with the Oceana Foundation, says saving the glaciers was a concern, but water is a more pressing issue.
Pero otro de los problemas es la contaminación de las aguas. Por ejemplo, ese es un problema que no se elimina, aun cuando.
The other concern is the contamination of the watershed, a problem that will not go away despite the treatment of waters by the company, because underground waters will become polluted, and this is a water resource for future generations. Also, there is a filtration of heavy metals leaching from waste rock that can pollute the river that is a source of rural water.
Environmental groups and Huasco Valley residents will appeal the Pascua-Lama mine to the Council of Ministers, an appeal that will have to be decided by the incoming government of President Michelle Bachelet that takes office next March 11th. Bachelet is on record as saying that she does not like the Pascua-Lama mining project. Environmentalists and Huasco Valley residents hope Bachelet's comments lead towards the cancellation of this controversial mining project. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.
This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 23rd of February, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Louisiana's Gulf Coast tribes are struggling to survive in the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Many tribal members had their homes 10 feet off the ground but were still flooded and are angry about what they say was preventable disaster. In the first of a three-part series, Andrew Stelzer reports on why the erosion of bayou marshlands may be swallowing up land which has been home to several tribes for centuries.
There used to be land all around. Now it's basically the back door.
Randy Vernon is the chief of the Bayou Lafourche Band at the Biloxi Chittimacha. He says that over the last 40 or 50 years, the marshlands, peninsulas, and islands, which his and several other tribes call home, have been disappearing into the Gulf of Mexico.
The drain of wetlands, the saltwater intrusion, because of the oilfield industries coming in and cutting through the land, you get the saltwater coming in through those canals. It starts eating away at the marshland, and basically it just starts falling into the Gulf. There's no vegetation there to hold the land together, so you just start getting this massive land loss. What used to protect us was the land between our homes and the Gulf Coast, so when that water, that surge came, you had land before it actually got to our communities. Well, now that land is gone. So when that surge comes, the communities are the first things that it hits. And that's why, for the most part, three out of the four Indian communities here got anywhere between 6 and 8, 10 feet of water.
Chucky Verdin, chairman of the Pontotian Indian tribe, says levees need to be built and the barrier islands that are sinking should be covered with rocks and filled with sand.
Every hurricane we get, the water gets higher because they got less land, they got less islands, whatever, to slow down the storm surge.
Now we have people who, after Juan, after Andrew, you know, they say, well, I'm going to raise their home to right above that level, a foot or two higher than what the water came. But like I said, every hurricane that comes, you get more water. So this last hurricane, people had never had, you know, who thought they were safe, they still got water.
The tribes are fighting to get federal recognition, which could bring in much-needed funds to preserve their own history.
The erosion keep on getting closer and closer to these cemeteries, to these Indian mounds. And if we would have the funds, we could go down there and build a levee around there or you know, preserve it ourselves.
And until they start pushing or allowing more fresh water coming in from the Mississippi River and allowing those things to start bringing sediment and rebuilding the coastal area, I don't see any reverse happening anytime soon. In 10 years, 20 years, I don't know what you're going to see here. You can look at these areas and know that once upon a time, there was a house there. In our community, you go down to Bayou now, what used to be where my grandfather had cows and had a house and had chickens and had a garden and everything, now you have dead oak trees. And everything around it is dead.
From Pointe aux Chiens, Louisiana, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
The California Supreme Court has ruled more environmental studies must be done before a Northern California tribe can move forward with plans to build a new casino. Ellen Churchak reports from Sacramento.
The state Supreme Court let stand a lower court ruling requiring more air quality studies before construction of a casino near Shingle Springs, just outside of Sacramento. Despite the ruling, officials with the Shingle Springs Band of Miwok Indians say they are pleased to have a definitive answer so they can move forward with the environmental reports. They believe the new studies will take only a few months to complete. County officials have challenged the casino plans in court, saying the casino will bring in more traffic and cause increased air pollution. Plans call for an 84,000-square-foot casino with a 2,400-car garage with a hotel to be added later. The plans have been on hold for years, though, because of legal fights between the tribe and local residents and officials. I'm Ellen Churchak in Sacramento.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, using engineering and science to improve the quality of the environment for over 15 years. RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a native venture protecting Indian country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Our theme music is provided by Jeff Silverman. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Good evening. It's a couple of minutes before 6 o'clock, and the previous KBOO news program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Children's Theater presenting the world premiere of The Giver, the story of a boy learning of the tragic sacrifices his community has made for safety and security. The Giver runs March 5th, 11th, and 12th at 2 p.m. at Keller Auditorium, 222 Southwest Clay. Tickets at 503-228-9571 or Ticketmaster.com. Appropriate for ages 10 and up. Information about The Giver at octc.org. And it is coming up to 6 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor An Evening in Vietnam, a benefit for Village School Foundation. Experience Vietnamese culture through music and dance featuring nationally known guitarist and storyteller Dun. Enjoy Vietnamese food and a special video presentation of the Village School Foundation's recent efforts to provide education resources to the children of Vietnam. The event will be held at 6:30 p.m. Saturday, February 25th at the PCC Rock Creek Campus, Building Number 3. For more information, please call 503-957-0740 or 503-997-2260.